Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spark Radio Show, filled with strategies, possibilities, actions, resources, and knowledge that may be the spark of a better solution to ignite a positive change in your life. The number to call if you have questions for Melanie or any of our guests is area code 347-215-8390. Now, here's your host, Ms. Melanie.
Well, hello, and thank you for joining us here at Spark Radio. I am your host, Ms. Melanie, and as always, it is my pleasure to spend time with you. I'm very glad that you've chosen to spend time with us to learn about those sparks that can be igniting that positive change in your life. And I'm very excited to welcome back one of our guest who has wonderful ideas and strategies. And before I introduce him, want to encourage you to take a look at a special series that we are hosting. We are launching the Brain Booster Club this weekend. And we are excited because we are offering four 30-minute shows in a brain-a-thon, and you can find them here at Blog Talk Radio. Just take a look. And we're very excited about the Brain Booster Club and what that offers, and we'll say more about that for later because I want to spend the bulk of today with our guest. Our guest tonight is Mr. Frank Cross with the Upside Down Organization. He's a certified brain-based trainer and so much more. And so, welcome, Frank.
Hi, Melanie. Great to be back with you.
Thank you so much for joining me. Our exciting topic tonight is the new IQ, which is intriguing all by itself. But before we get into that topic, Frank, would you tell listeners who may not have heard our past interviews a little bit about your passion for learning and how you got here?
Sure. I'm the president of the Upside Down Organization, and we are a training and learning experience organization that uses neuroscience and culture to try and advance and accelerate and address all the learning needs of our students. And so I'm based out of an organization called the Children's Guild. We're a large nonprofit children's services organization based in Maryland. And we serve children in a wide variety of programs, non-public schools, public charter schools, group homes, therapeutic foster care, autism centers, outpatient mental health centers, et cetera. And we began using a model that we call transformation education, which, as I mentioned, is a combination of the disciplines of anthropology, this idea that every group of adults that gets together in any kind of organized fashion forms a culture, whether that's a school culture, a work culture, a family culture, a community culture. And it's that culture that really does the educating of our children. It's that culture that tells children who they are, who other people are, how they learn, how they grow, how they should dress, how they should speak, how they should think, et cetera. And most of those organizations just kind of let that culture happen. In essence, it is what it is. But in transformation education, we believe it's the most powerful tool for teaching kids the values and life skills we want them to have. So we intentionally shape the culture, build tools to help implement the values and beliefs we want to see in the culture, and then have monitoring processes for the culture. So we intentionally harness that power of culture to help kids grow and learn. And we marry that, we combine that with these just tremendous findings from neuroscience about how our kids learn. And the Upside Down Organization name comes from the idea that many of the things we've learned about children's brains and how the biological process of learning, both academically and behaviorally, actually happens, you know, many of the findings confirm longstanding practices that really excellent teachers and child care workers and social workers have had. But what's much more interesting to us is many other findings turn upside down preconceived notions and often institutionalized practices that really have no support in the science or in the literature about how the brain works. And we get excited about sharing these ideas, ideas that work, ideas that have been effective, particularly with very challenging situations. And we married these two ideas, culture and neuroscience, implemented a program called Transformation Education. It's been very successful for us. So the Upside Down organization is out to spread that word, get people excited about these areas and using the techniques, and that's how I got here.
Wow. And that's a word I use a lot when I interview Frank. If you have not heard Frank before, you can search through the archives of Spark. You'll find an interview on July 20th, and the other one is in early June about topics from brain-inspired strategies for bullies, the adolescent brain. And last time we talked about changing your language, changing their lives, which is filled with amazing strategies for teachers and parents around language. And tonight, Frank brings his expertise with transformation education to the new IQ. So, Frank, what is the new IQ?
Well, the new IQ is the name we give our learning experience that discusses executive functioning, the executive functioning skills in the brain. And the new IQ name comes from the idea that much more important than IQ or cognitive ability is the ability to execute or act on your knowledge. And these sets of skills that we call the executive system in the brain are the single most important determinant in our mind of how successful children are in life. And consequently, the new IQ tries to focus our attention on learning what those skills are, being able to recognize when those skills are lagging, and then being able to teach strategies and practices that strengthen those skills and give kids those all-important skills that they need.
Well, let's start with the elementary age, because I am going to guess that these executive function skills are taught differently based on the age of the brain that you have. So we can either talk a little bit chronologically, or we can take a different approach to sharing this. What works best for you?
That's fine. The chronological approach, because you're absolutely right. The executive function skills, the location, in essence, in the brain where they primarily occur is the frontal lobes of the brain. And the frontal lobes of the brain behind the forehead back to about the middle top of your head is the last area of the brain to fully develop and mature in human beings. It takes the longest amount of time, and it's the most complex and sophisticated area of the brain. So obviously it begins developing in utero, but even in utero, it takes a long time for the brain to develop. So 28 weeks for the central nervous system, including the brain, to develop in utero, and that's the longest it takes any system in the brain to develop prior to birth. After birth, it takes on average 25 years for the frontal lobes, i.e. the executive systems of the brain, to fully develop and mature. And consequently, we have all kinds of developmental milestones and stages of executive functioning development. And many of our, cultural and systemic practices and systems are based on this. So, for example, when we start children in school is typically around the age of formal school, kindergarten, around the age of five, because that's the age at which the frontal lobes are developed enough where children have enough impulse control to be able to learn in a group setting. Now, we've moved that a little bit earlier in terms of preschools, but preschools sometimes have their challenges that way because they mix children, obviously by necessity, who have different frontal lobe maturity. And then isn't it interesting that we actually pass children, matriculate children onto grades based really on two considerations. One, are they academically on par, say, for example, to move from second grade to third grade? But more importantly, do they have the impulse control? Do they have the executive function skills, the organization skills, the time management skills to be able to handle second grade work, to be able to manage their behavior effectively, to be able to work cooperatively with others? And so whether we knew it or not, our evaluation of executive functioning has long been a part of education. We haven't necessarily called it executive functioning or maturity of the frontal lobes, but that's certainly what it is. So what we see is in each executive functioning skill, we have a developmental trajectory. We can, within a certain range, expect certain behavior out of children in the executive functioning realms, and our judgment on that behavior often determines how quickly those children advance or whether we feel they need additional time for those skills to develop. So if we start, for example, with young children, we can see that, for example, impulse control, a young child can wait a fairly short period of time without being disrupted for something that they want. Their ability to delay gratification, so to speak, is relatively short, and we kind of expect that from young children. As children mature and grow, we would expect, for example, in early adolescence and certainly in high school, that delay of gratification can be a long time and fairly extensive and particularly involve very powerful emotions. So a good example might be an adolescent who's playing on the basketball team or on the soccer field in high school and disagrees with the referee's call and feels very strongly that the referee was wrong, can nonetheless accept that call without an argument, modulate their behavior, control their impulses, and act appropriately in the situation. And that range of behaviors certainly signifies what we call, right, maturity. And more than any other set of skills, it's the executive skills that determine maturity. So it might be helpful to talk just for a minute about what executive function is and kind of get an idea of, or let me share the idea at least how I think about it in terms of understanding this set of skills. So the group of skills that we call executive functioning, one of the definitions I really like comes from Dawson and Guare's research, but they call it brain-based skills required for humans to execute or perform tasks. And I really like that definition, one, for its simplicity, but two, because it really gets to the essence of what the executive skills do for kids and do for us as adults. They allow us to act on our knowledge. They allow us to act on all of this great information that our brains have downloaded and stored into memory, and now we can do something with it. So executive function skills are very active. They allow us to carry out activities and behaviors that use this information that the brain is so good at learning. And it's a very complex set of skills. In fact, no other species on the planet comes even close to the complexity of abilities that humans have in the executive functioning realm. So one of the quotes, Melanie, I really, really like is this one from a sixth grade teacher who's talking about a student in her class named Bill. And she says this, quote, "Bill is probably the brightest, most creative student in the classroom. He shines during discussions, and his insights into what we are learning are keener than his classmates. But Bill does not turn in his homework consistently. He fails to prepare for tests and is always late with long-term projects. If he would only develop a little motivation and not be so lazy, he would be a truly exceptional student," unquote. And I like to use that quote to talk about executive functioning because many times the lack of certain executive function skills looks like a lack of motivation or laziness or that the student just doesn't care or doesn't have support from home many things that we attribute to behavioral or motivational issues with kids, and actually they're a lack of skills. And specifically executive functioning skills. In other words, it's not that the student isn't bright. Bill, in this case, is obviously very bright, as the teacher says. The problem is Bill doesn't know how to execute or act on his brightness to carry out the complex functions that we expect in a classroom. And so I think the metaphor that I really like for executive function is the Captain Kirk, so to speak, of the brain. And if you recall Captain Kirk from Star Trek, he's at the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. Like our brains and bodies, this ship, the Starship Enterprise, is huge. It has tremendous resources. It has engines and a crew and all kinds of, you know, terrific technology. But it is completely ineffectual if it's not being led, if it's not being captained by someone who knows how to use it to its full extent. And so Captain Kirk represents for us on the bridge our executive system, and he can direct the ship and its resources accordingly based on the context of the situation. And without Captain Kirk, the ship, as powerful as it is and all the resources it has, is really in chaos and cannot act effectively at all. And that's what our executive system does for us. Now, sometimes it's easy for us to take for granted the complexity of executive function skills that we ask kids to use every day. So particularly in fourth grade, moving into fifth grade, and certainly by the time you go to middle school in sixth grade, we're actually putting great demands on children's executive systems. So let's take homework, for example. So when a teacher gives in middle school, let's say sixth grade, homework to students, often what sometimes is missed is the fact that seven other teachers often are giving homework also, either on the same day or the next day. And each of these teachers that a student has in these multiple classes have different requirements for that homework. So to successfully complete homework assignments, the student must do the following. First, has to know what homework assignments are due for each of these various classes. Secondly, has to know when the assignments are due for each class. Third, has to possess the necessary books or materials to do the homework. And with my son in particular, this was brought home because he has A days and B days. So on days he has classes that are A day classes, the homework he needs to do that night is not A day homework. It's B day homework, because that's the next day when the homework has to be turned in. So he has to remember that he needs his A books in his locker to go to class, but it's his B books he needs to bring home that night to do homework. And that often can be enormously confusing. So possessing the right books or materials can be a real challenge. Then he has to complete the required work according to the directions given by that teacher. And teachers often give widely varying directions for how they want things done. But in addition to completing it, he has to finish all the required parts of the assignments with the appropriate care and quality required by that individual teacher. And here, teachers vary widely. Some teachers have a very specific demand and have very hardline approaches to how they want a particular assignment done, what format, what method, etc. Other teachers are much more lax in this. And so the student, in completing homework, has to calculate, so to speak, what level of quality they need to do for each teacher. And then finally, they have to turn in the assignment using the preferred convention of that particular teacher. And this would be challenging with one teacher, but with seven or eight or nine teachers, as some students have, this is enormously challenging to the early executive development of those students. So executive function skills often are the first determinant, not intelligence or IQ, are often the first determinant of how children respond to the increasing demands we make on executive function as they move through the grades.
Well, I think those are such powerful points for parents to understand, and sometimes we forget that those young brains are different. They don't think the same way we do because our frontal lobe processes the decision-making and the consequences very differently. We organize information differently. And so what we look at, and I'm thinking when you said A and B days, my son just started fifth grade, and it's the first time with A and B days. And so organizing all the different classes and expectations, which can really be overwhelming. And what a powerful statement for parents that there's a difference between intelligence and executive function.
Absolutely. And you can have very, very high IQ, a brilliant brain, and lack average executive functioning skills, and you are going to really struggle in school. And I'm sure that you've heard from many parents, as I have, who will come up to me and start out by saying, my son or my daughter is enormously bright. They're very smart. But, and then the but usually is some significant issue they're having in school. And I know as a parent myself, what you worry about first is, you know, is there something wrong with my child? Is there something abnormal? Is there something mentally or emotionally wrong with them such that they're not able to perform in school? And in this workshop on the new IQ, what I'm trying to communicate is there's typically nothing wrong. It's very, very often just a lack of skills, skills that both parents and teachers take for granted. Not that we're bad people. The reason we take them for granted is we have them, and we use them all the time. They're like second nature to us by the time we're adults. And so we expect, and you know, an error we often make is we expect that our children's brains work like our brains, and our children think like we think. And as you just pointed out, and you know so well, Melanie, they don't think like we do. Just about everything's different in their brains, and in fact, they don't even use the same part of their brains to do identical tasks that adults do. And so understanding that can really be empowering because first it takes away feeling that something's wrong with my kid or I've done something wrong as a parent and focuses it on this is like being able to add or subtract or color within the lines or any of those other skills our kids develop as they grow if we give them enough practice and assistance. And so I think it's enormously empowering and kind of freeing for parents. They certainly have to do some work, as you know, teachers do too, but it's much more optimistic and hopeful, that work in attitude, if we know it's a matter of teaching some lagging skills rather than something being, quote, wrong, unquote, with a particular child.
Well, and what are, there's maybe some parents saying, oh my gosh, this is amazing news because I know now that it's executive function that's causing the challenges that my son or daughter is having with their organization or, you know, forgetting to bring home the right books or whatever that may be. So what are some strategies that parents can use to help teach those lagging skills, let's say, in that middle school 4, 5, 6 age?
Right.
5, 6 grade, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and one of the things to start with right before the strategies is just what are some of these skills? Because there's a lot more of them than typically we might recognize. And so in the teaching that we do, there are 11 of these skills. And some of the researchers and writers in the area have as many as 28. But we focus on 11. Time management, working memory, organization, a term called metacognition, which is what we adults would call reflection or looking back on our behavior or effort and evaluating it as objectively as we can, planning and sequencing, flexibility, emotional control, sustained attention, sometimes referred to as focus, task initiation, the all-important impulse control, and then goal-directed persistence, which means that you stick with the goal despite obstacles. And those are kind of the 11 kind of critical or key ones, and the lack of any one of them can affect all of the others. So let's take, for example, time management. And time management is, the capacity to estimate how much time one has, and then to decide how to allocate that time, and then to have the discipline to stay within the time limits and deadlines. And for many kids, another aspect of time management is this sense that time is important. And sometimes maturity-wise, that's one of the things that, takes the longest for some kids is to get that appreciation that time is important. They procrastinate, they dawdle, they don't get started on things, et cetera. So let's take, for example, a situation in fourth or fifth grade, and you don't have good time management skills. And another aspect of time management is called time orientation, the ability to accurately track the passage of time. So if I lack time orientation and time management skills, and in the fifth grade, which in Maryland, for example, is one of the grades in which you take the Maryland State Assessments, the standardized tests. And those standardized tests are 50 questions, for example, on one aspect of it, and there are multiple choice questions, 50 multiple choice questions, and you have 50 minutes to take that test. A typical good executive function, good time management skilled kid will immediately, before the test even starts, figure out, hey, I've got 1 minute per question, and they have an internal clock going on in their head that tells them, yeah, that took me about 1 minute, or that only took me about a half a minute, so for a difficult question, I've got an extra 30 seconds. Or that question took me 2 minutes, I'm really going to have to use only about 15 or 20 seconds on a couple of others to make sure I finish on time. And those students finish the 50 questions right before 50 minutes. But those kids without executive function skill of time management or time orientation, those are the kids who are on question 24, when the teacher says time's up. And they have, no lack of motivation. They have no less intelligence. They simply don't have the skill of time management or time orientation to allow them to finish that test on time, to track accurately how much time it's taken them on each question. And they're as surprised as the teacher is when they only see they're on 24 when they're supposed to be on 50. And unfortunately, those kids get labeled pretty quickly and judged as unmotivated, or they don't care, or they just don't get it, or they don't have the intelligence to, complete the whole test or know all of the information, when in fact it's a lagging skill. So for time management, what kinds of things can we do? One of my favorite time management skills actually involves an object, and it's called a time timer, or I affectionately call it an ADHD clock. And this clock, as opposed to either digital clocks or the clocks that move their hands, or what's more common now, the clocks on kids' cell phones, right? This clock has a face that's like a pie chart. In other words, if you can imagine a face that's a circle that's all red, okay? And it has zero at the top, where 12 would be on a clock face, all the way around to 55 and back to the zero. So it's set at up to 60 minutes at a time. And you turn the clock face so that the red circle is displayed for how much time the child has to do a certain task, be it take a test or do their homework. And instead of the hands moving and the clock ticking, it's entirely silent, but the red goes away. And when there's no red, that means the time is up. In other words, the child can visually very carefully track the passage of time without being so distracted like you would in a second hand or trying to see the large hand of a clock move, which is nearly impossible, and being distracted from your work. With this clock, you can look up occasionally and see how much of the pie chart, so to speak, is left. And with practice and use of this device, kids learn that time orientation. They learn to time themselves much more accurately and establish through external means the internal clock they need to be able to function effectively in a classroom on time tests or other types of timed assignments. Another thing very effective is kids with time management, time orientation problems have difficulty with long-term projects. Projects that take, for example, a couple of weeks to do, science fair projects, term papers, etc. Because it's difficult for them to track, right, 50 minutes. It's going to be really tough for them to track for 3 weeks. And so here, both teachers and parents can help by cueing externally the student as to what they should be doing at a specific stage. So, for example, a teacher might simply take their instructions for the entire assignment, writing a term paper over a three-week period where you have research and then you have notes that are made and then condense the notes and then develop an outline and then write paragraphs of the outline, etc. The teacher would take that and literally take scissors and cut up the various parts of those instructions, put them on different colored pieces of paper, and at the time where the child should either have it completed or be working on it, the teacher literally gives that slip of paper to the child. Because giving the student the whole instructions and you know, believing that they'll be able to follow through with that really isn't going to help. They need to be given a piece of the instruction at the time where the student should be working on it. In other words, it tells the student, it cues the student, okay, at this time, this is what I should be working at. And then 4 days later, whenever the next significant landmark is time-wise, then the teacher or the parent gives the child the next slip of paper and the next slip of paper and the next slip of paper. So what the child has is, let's say, in their room or in their homework area, they have a copy of the complete instructions. Say it's on a single sheet of paper, one-sided. And then as they get the slips of paper and complete them, right beside the full instructions, they're pasting, right, the piece of instruction that they've done at the right time until they have an exact duplicate of the complete instructions that were on the left. But the key is we've cued them at the specific time they need to be doing that. And this helps them to learn, again, that time orientation, that time management, and it all starts with the external cueing. So that's kind of the primary strategy when it comes to teaching time management, is because it's not happening internally in the frontal lobe, we've got to make the cues external for the kids. And by making them external and then they engage in the behavior, they practice the time management with the external aid, we're teaching internally their frontal lobe to develop those skills.
Oh, wow. Because so often teachers will just say, yep, here it is, and it's due in 3 weeks. And then they don't talk about it again until the project's due. And even as a parent and a certified brain-based trainer, my son has this issue, and it's very distracting, even in our morning routine of getting ready, and he does not judge time passing, which I still, if I don't have that external clock, my internal clock is very different. So my way of helping him is telling him the time, like every 5 minutes. Well, that disrupts his thought process if he's doing homework, for example. And so I can imagine that I'm going to have some people who listen to this recording later who are going to go, oh, my gosh, where do I get a clock like that to help my child get a better sense of how much time is passing? Do you have a source?
Two places to get it. The time timers or the ADHD clocks, as I call it. You don't have to have ADHD to benefit from it, but ADHD is a frontal lobe, you know, disorder that involves a lot of executive function skills, so that's why I call it that, and it's because I have had a little bit of that issue myself. So I say that most affectionately, but you can get the clocks at our website, www.upsidedownorganization.org, O-R-G, www.upsidedownorganization.org, or you can get it at super, S-U-P-E-R, duper, D-O-O-P-E-R, productions.com. So either one of those places, you can order them. They come in three sizes, a small individual size, a medium size, and a very large classroom size. So, for example, in most of the classrooms in our schools at the Children's Guild, the teachers have replaced the hand clocks with these clocks, particularly after, say, the fourth grade. Why? Because by the fourth grade, the kids know how to tell time on a typical hand clock with a second hand. And what the teachers want, once you know how to tell time, is they want them to be able to track time accurately. And the time timer does that much more effectively than a hand clock, or what's worse for the brain actually is a digital clock, because digital clocks are, as far as time management skills go, are useless. And I really want to emphasize that, because I know many new schools are being built and they put digital clocks in. And it's nearly impossible, particularly for a young brain, to accurately follow the passage of time on a digital clock, because there's nothing moving. The numbers just change. At least with a hand clock, you know, the hands are moving and the second hand is moving. But the time timer clock is much better. And I just did a workshop today, and during a break had a mom come to me who has a child and shared a story about getting the time timer that was recommended and how effective that was in helping their child get homework done, you know, chunking their instruction, learning to track the passage of time. They're remarkably effective. But one last thing, Melanie, because you got me all fired up about this one, talking about your son, is morning routines. Because here's a combination that will help you. Because the other issue that usually happens along with the time is the sequencing. In other words, how do I get my morning routine where I'm doing things in an order that's efficient, that gets me doing the things I need to do to be ready to go to school, and then do it in the proper time? So one of the combinations you can make is a picture book with the time timer. And this is how it works. So you would do this on a Saturday or a non-school day so that it's more relaxed when you do this portion. But you're just going to get your camera, your cell phone camera, your home camera, an Instamatic camera, you know, go down behind a disposable camera. And you're going to have your son model each major stage or each major step in his morning routine, what it makes sense for him to do first, second, third, etc. So it might be wake up, brush the teeth, get dressed, or have breakfast and then brush the teeth. You know, people are different that way. Get your books ready, feed the cat, whatever it might be. But you take a photograph, a single photograph of each major step. And then you just get a small, you know, photo book, photo album, a real small one, maybe 6 by 6 inches, not much bigger than that, or you can put it on a poster, or you can laminate the pictures, punch a hole in the top left-hand corner, and put them on a key ring. I've seen them done any of those three ways. And then what you do is you're then going to take a second picture. So after the picture of the stages, you're going to take a second picture of that time timer clock that shows that with 45 minutes before we leave for school, this is the behavior you should be doing, i.e. brushing your teeth. And then 40 minutes before school, this is the behavior you should be doing, which is getting dressed, all the way down through the pictures. And you'll have about 7 or 8 pictures. And then so you put the pictures in the album, and then right next to the picture goes the picture of the time timer that shows how much time is left when he should be doing that. And those two things together are powerful cues to the brain. They are literally external frontal lobes, an external executive system where he can look at it. You don't have to interrupt him, right? Because you're absolutely right. When you interrupt him and tell him the time, breaks his sequence, breaks his concentration, probably makes him a little anxious. But if he can look at the picture and say, all right, with this much left on the time timer, this size of the pie, say, for example, 45 minutes, which is going to look like a quarter of the pie out, you know, a quarter white out, 3/4 red in, this is what I should be doing. Okay, at 40 minutes left, this is what I should be doing. And it's immediate, it's visual, and it really teaches that time orientation and that sequence orientation together, which will get your morning routine on the right track in a very short period of time, maybe a week, 10 days. You'll be amazed at the difference it makes.
Well, I'm excited to try it, because we also tried an alarm on the cell phone, which just annoyed him, because one of us would have to go find it and turn it off. And so what we've tried so far has been less than effective. So this strategy, again, was giving external cues as a way of teaching that executive function, teaching the brain is a very different mindset than the frustration a lot of parents have in the mornings with the fact that my child won't get out of bed, or they're taking too long to get dressed, or they're distracted by whatever it is that they're doing. And so looking at it as how it's teachable and how I as a parent can empower that brain with the skills is very exciting.
Yeah, and I describe it as getting the parents out of the negative loop, because it becomes a very negative loop. You feel like you're always yelling at your kid, or, you know, you're always, if not yelling, you know, frustrated, and it's you that always has to tell them what they should be doing. Now, look at the parallel, because it's important. When you tell them what they should be doing, and when the alarm goes off, right? Well, the alarm goes off, but then you still have to tell them what to do if they don't remember, right? So all the alarm does is cue you to give them a command, which is okay, but it's not building any self-reliance, right? Any self-discipline where they can do it. And what the picture book does, it'll take you out of the loop. All he has to do, for my son Keenan, for example, all Keenan has to do, and I don't mean all to minimize it, it's complex, but Keenan just has to look at the picture and the time, right? He looks at the picture and he sees what he should be doing by that time. He looks at the actual timer, which is running in real time, and he can tell I'm on time, I'm ahead of time, or I'm behind time, i.e. I need to speed up. All right, I'm okay. I don't need to go any faster. Or, you know, I got a few minutes. I can spend longer here. And you, the parent, are out of the loop. He's doing that completely independently. In other words, once you set up the system, right, then you can step out and let him manage that system, because he's got the necessary cues. And so what happens is, instead of you being the cue, you're setting up the cue that he can use himself. And that self-reliance and self-discipline that develops is something that obviously all of us parents want. And then most importantly, it gets you out of that constant negative loop where you're having an unpleasant morning because you always feel like you're on them, you know, for them to do what you want them to do.
And the child's also frustrated because they feel like they're not doing it right, and you end up with them heading off to school in a negative mental and emotional state as well. So this is very powerful. And again, as parents, we don't get this. We don't get an owner's manual for the brains of our kids. And as teachers, they are only taught what is currently known. And for some of our teachers who've been in the profession a long time, they're very caring and very committed to success. And like you said in your introduction, they're teaching in ways that are not based in research now. And so we have about 17 minutes left. I want to give you some more time to share more information. So I'll stop talking and let you go to where you want to head next.
Oh, no problem. And for teachers, you know, it really is a paradigm shift. And I love working with teachers, because I'm not sure, except maybe for social workers and doctors and those in the helping profession, that there are any more committed professionals out there. But teachers are facing a tremendous paradigm shift that we are continually adjusting to in education, because it wasn't that long ago where how we did education was the local school was in essence a reflection, a microcosm of the local community. And at that time, in many places, the local community pretty much had the same values, had the same backgrounds. People grew up in their hometowns and consequently, you know, went to school in their hometowns. We didn't have as much mobility, and it was much more likely to be successful to be able to teach a classroom of students in a single way and have that single way be successful for most of them. That was the American school. But today, it's a totally new environment. Today, the driving force is differentiation. Today, we don't have homogenous communities. Today, we have very, very different brains at completely different levels, even though we put them in the same classroom because they're the same age. And widely varying skills, widely varying learning styles and abilities. And in our melting pot nation, which we value so highly, we are certainly seeing the challenge of that in the classroom, because the differences in brains are tremendous, and they're extreme in many cases. But because we use the same system, i.e., putting kids of the same age in the same grade with one teacher to teach them a subject, means that teachers are going to have to continually refine their skills and become more diverse, more differentiated in how they teach kids in a classroom, because not all of them are going to learn the same way. So used to be, if you had two, three, you know, maybe four different techniques or teaching styles you could use, you were at the top of your profession as a teacher. But today you might need 11, 12, 15 different ways to teach the same material and be able to do that in a shorter period of time than you had when you were teaching in one way. And that puts a lot of stress and strain on teachers, understandably, and makes it a very challenging profession that way. But the opportunity, right, the promise of being able to reach different brains and be effective with them, I know continues to draw many to the field and keep them in the field. One more piece on the picture book, because you talked about teachers. Seen teachers do wonderful things with the picture book and the timer, particularly as it comes to classroom routines. Science teachers who are running labs take pictures of the kids in their lab routines. When you come into the lab, what are the steps that you take? You hang up your coat, you put on your safety glasses, you put on your white coat or your gloves, latex gloves, you check out the microscope, you know, whatever the steps are. They take photographs of them, and then they make a poster and post that poster in the room so that the teacher every day isn't telling students what they need to do to follow the right procedure. Students are just referencing the posters. With young children, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, teachers take pictures of the morning routine, how you come into the classroom, putting your coat in your cubby, going to play at one of the play areas, what toys you can use or what books you can access, and then they put them on half sheets of construction paper, post the pictures there, laminate them, punch that hole in the top left-hand corner, put them on a key ring, and then they hang them at the child's level in the room on a hook. So the child comes in and is able to simply pick up the key ring and quickly riffle through the photographs and remember what they're to do at what particular time. So it's a technique that's very effective in a wide variety of situations. But let's jump quickly to another really important executive functioning skill, and that's working memory, sometimes referred to as short-term memory. And this one is one that's often not considered when kids are having problems, but has profound effect on their performance, even when they're highly intelligent. So working memory or short-term memory, they both are the same thing, is the ability to hold information in your memory while you're performing complex tasks. And this is particularly true, Melanie, when we're looking at what we ask kids so many times to do in learning, and that's compare, contrast, what's the same, what's different, how is this like this, how is it different from this, to analyze and evaluate different ideas and arguments requires the ability to hold more than one idea or one example in your mind at the same time, in your memory. And if you're not able to do that, you can't hold more than one thought at a time, then even the most basic practices like being able to follow multi-step directions are impossible for you to do. And your ability to draw on your past learning or experience to apply that knowledge or that experience from your past to a new project or situation is also affected, because you can't hold the memory of what I learned yesterday, say, in the order of operations in math, to the new problem that I have in algebra, because I can't hold that in my memory long enough if I don't have good working or short-term memory. So, for example, a young child in kindergarten or first grade, we would see, right, can maybe follow a one- or two-step direction okay. But once you get to three or four, certainly five-step oral directions, they're lost. They can't follow all the way through. You know, so if you say, okay, when I say go, I want you to stand up, push in your chair, lift your right foot up off the floor at the knee, point your finger and write your name cursively. You know, five-step direction. Well, most of those kids are done right after you say stand up and push your chair in. They can't remember, right, the rest of the directions, and they're asking, well, what are we supposed to do, et cetera. That's because their short-term memory or the working memory ability hasn't matured yet. A middle school child, however, can, as we talked about earlier, often remember the expectations of multiple teachers and how those expectations are different depending on who the teacher is. So here we have maturity and continued growth and progression such that students can often remember, oh, yeah, Mrs. Holland says no trapper keepers, but Mr. Cruz, you can have a trapper keeper in his class. And so working memory, very underestimated or maybe what's more accurate, underappreciated skill. From as simple as following directions to more complex, the ability to compare and contrast ideas and concepts. So one of the things I really like for parents and for teachers as an activity to boost working memory is called add-on, ADD and hyphen O-N, add-on. So you can do this at the dinner table. You can do this, obviously, in a classroom with a group of kids. But you're seated at the dinner table. One of you is going to start. So I'll use my family. My wife's name is Sean. My daughter's name is Mackenzie. My son's name is Keenan, and there's me. So let's say I start. There's a couple of ways to do it. The most simple way is with numbers. So you pick a number between 1 and 99, the person that's starting. So let's say I pick 22, and then I move to my right. Let's say that's my wife who's sitting on my right. Sean has to say the number I picked, i.e. use her short-term memory, 22, and then she picks a number, let's say 41. And then it moves on to Mackenzie. Mackenzie has to say my number, 22, Sean's number, 41, and her number, 19. Then it moves on to Keenan. He has to say 22, 41, 19, and then his number, 13. And we keep doing that, and we go as far as we can, right, with our short-term memory to remember as many of those numbers as we can, because you have to repeat every number that everybody gets before you add your own. And by doing this regularly, 3 to 5 times a week, what you're doing is you're it's like exercising your biceps by doing, you know, lifting weights. You're exercising the hippocampus, the short-term memory center of the brain, giving it good exercise and expanding its ability, because what you'll find is as you do it regularly, we remember more numbers as we go and as we practice it. Another way to do it is to pick a topic area. So let's say we're talking about science and the kids, one of the kids, Mackenzie or Keenan, is studying animals. What we would do is say, okay, we're going to do add-on with mammals. Everybody's got to name a mammal. All right, so I might start with, dolphins. And then Keenan might say gorillas, and he has to say dolphins, what Dad said, and then gorillas. And so here you've got two things going on. You've got to pull up content, i.e., which animals are mammals, and then you've got to remember what the previous person said. And so it can be fun. It can be content-based, but it gets you using your working memory and expanding it. It's simple. It's low cost. It doesn't take a lot of time. But, in fact, it can make a tremendous difference in your child's short-term memory capacity.
And you know I'm writing very, very quickly, and I'll remind listeners that the show is recorded. So when you listen to it later as a podcast or a download, you can pause as you're taking notes on doing this. And I'm excited to try this because it's amazing. And part of it, too, is when things are meaningful and important. My son can remember amazing things that were said in what we thought was passing, but oh, he remembers.
Yeah.
And yet, the thing that we wanted to remember that we think is important, like what he's supposed to bring home from school, not so much.
Right, right. And you know, you said it earlier, they kids think differently than we think, and obviously things that are relevant to us aren't necessarily relevant to them. That's true. Hey, one more, last one, and I know we're getting close on time, but let me give this one quickly because, again, it's another really fun one that kids like, and a really important skill, I think, that we would all agree for our kids. And it's sometimes referred to as sustained attention. Probably a simpler term for it is focus, and that's the capacity to keep paying attention to a situation or task despite distraction or fatigue or boredom. Probably, might be the most critical skill for many kids in school. They get bored and they get fatigued, et cetera. How do we help them extend their attention? And what I like are these picture books, so to speak, that they call them, where you have two pictures that look identical, but there are differences, and you've got to identify the difference. So the kids have to look at the pictures and then find out what's different. Second picture, even though it looks identical to the first. And Brain Games is a great company that publishes a lot of books that have these in them. And in the Brain Games books, they run developmentally. In other words, they'll give you some appropriate for 5 or 6 year olds all the way up to college students, these very complex pictures. And it's a lot of fun because, for example, the picture will say there are 5 differences. Can you find them in this picture? And what it requires your child to do is really focus and go back and forth between the pictures, right, and compare little tiny segments and little tiny objects within the picture. And what they're doing is they're focusing and they're sustaining their attention for extended periods of time in order to find the differences, because it's motivating for them, it's fun for them to do. What we're actually doing with them is building their focus and attention. So another fun way, it only takes a few minutes. One of these books will last you a whole semester in terms of the number of find the differences in there, or you can go to the web and put in your search engine, find the difference drawings, and you'll come up with a bunch of them at all different age levels. And it's just a way to give kids something fun.
I'm going to interrupt a minute because you're cutting out. And so when you, and it's just been in the last like 2 minutes that you started coming in and out. And when you were talking about going to the web, what were you talking about putting into the search engine?
Find the difference pictures or find the difference drawings.
Okay, thanks.
You bet. No problem. So that's another just quick one that you can use to help extend your child's ability to pay attention over time, extend the amount of time they're willing to do that, another important executive skill.
Frank, if people who are listening say, oh, my gosh, this was so helpful and so powerful, and look at all those other skills, where can they go to learn more?
Sure, they can go to our website, again, www.upsidedownorganization.org, and on that website you will find a calendar with our webinars on the new IQ, as well as our hosted workshops on the new IQ, as well as calendars that tell you where we're going to be, and if we're going to be in your area or if we're not in your area, the webinar is certainly a great way to participate. We cover all 11 skills and give you activities, strategies, practices for each of those skills.
Awesome. And if someone has a question and they want to contact you directly, what's the best way to reach you?
Best way is by email, my last name, which is Cross. It's easy pronunciation, funky spelling, K as in kitchen, R-O-S as in Sam, at upsidedownorganization.org.
Thank you so much. And as always, I hope that you'll join us again, whether it's here at Spark or at our new Brain Booster Club that we'll be launching this weekend, because there's so much that you have taken from, as you said, neuroscience and culture, and really created that upside down organization that is so learner-friendly and so empowering for young brains, as well as for the parents of those young brains, that I am so excited to share what you are doing with as many people as I can.
Well, I appreciate your support, and best of luck with Brain Booster Club. What a great idea. I know I'll be a member of the club. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much. And again, if you want to reach Frank, you can go to upsidedownorganization.org. Great resources. I really appreciate what I get from them in terms of newsletter and what's coming up. And I encourage you to take a look at Spark for the sessions coming up on everything from what are you feeding your brain to where are my keys coming up this weekend. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you again, Frank, for sharing wonderful information with my listeners. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here again, Melanie. Thank you.
And until next time, please take great care of the brains in your life, both yours and those you love. I look forward to being with you again.
Thank you for listening to Spark Radio with Miss Melanie. Please share this show link with those you believe would enjoy and benefit from listening. We invite you to join us for upcoming shows with special guests and more sparks. May a spark you heard ignite a positive change in your life. Good day.